This topic, if I can do it justice, has the potential to be fairly interesting. The title is a little prosaic. A good subtitle might have been From Forensics to Philosophy. We begin with the actual practical applications of our topic are essentially forensics, whether criminal cases, civil cases, family law cases. It's interesting, even when you read some of the law journal articles on this topic, they begin with things like, the topic we discuss here has been made popular in television shows like CSI and House, and you proceed from that to philosophy, epistemology, the system of halacha, how we know what we know, what's acceptable and based in, what do we do when halacha conflicts with science. So I aim to show today, survey, discuss the halachic literature on forensic identification. The literature begins about mostly about half a century ago, mid 20th century, and proceeds to the current day. We'll discuss the history of the attitudes of the poskim on this topic, the fundamental questions in halacha, the philosophical questions, the technical questions, some of the scientific questions, and also the hashgafic questions. And hopefully we'll give at least a survey. There actually has been something of an explosion of literature on this topic, especially in the last 10, 20 years. Articles, primary literature, tshuvas, secondary literature. Not going to have time to cover it all, certainly, but hopefully we can give a basic survey of what the issues are and how the poskim deal with such questions, halacha l'maisa. So, first of all, just a little background on what we're discussing. When we do tissue testing, initially it was blood typing, first ABO, then HLA. Now we do it via DNA testing. So there are basically two fundamental sets of questions that we deal with. First of all, there's inclusion versus exclusion. If we want to know, we have a body, we have a sample of bodily tissue, blood or something on a crime scene. We want to know, is this blood, is this body, is this so-and-so, or is this not so-and-so? So a test can either exclude him, can say this is definitely not so-and-so. A test can either confirm with a greater or lesser degree of certainty that this is so-and-so, or the test can be inconclusive. Sometimes we're primarily interested in inclusion, sometimes we're primarily interested in exclusion, sometimes the more information we have is better. So that's always the first question. Are we dealing with inclusion or exclusion? The other fundamental thing is, sometimes we deal with questions of identity. We want to know, let's say in a criminal case, are the traces of biological material found at the scene, are they from the suspect or are they not from the suspect? Sometimes we want to know paternity. We want to know paternity both for questions like child support. Is the putative father expected to pay child support? In halacha, there are other concerns, mamzerus, yichus. So we'll discuss as we go, we'll see how the poskim dealt with these various questions. We have inclusion and exclusion, we have identity, and we have paternity. Now, the various halachic areas in which the poskim have discussed tissue testing have been roughly three or four main areas. In terms of identity, so in the secular law system, the most common question of identity certainly is criminal justice. When we find we find samples of saliva, blood, something else at a crime scene, we need to know, does this belong to a person we suspect of the crime? If so, we can place him at the scene and possibly convict him. Halacha, we deal not that much in a practical way with criminal justice. Truth is, an initial flyer we prepared for the program was a little more dramatic than the one we actually used. It showed a man behind bars. The bars were composed of the double helix of the DNA, which I guess was supposed to represent exoneration or conviction of a suspect based on DNA. So I was something of a killjoy, and I suggested we use a different flyer because halacha has not really dealt with criminal justice in the last century or so. Unfortunately, since around the time of the Churban, the destruction of the temple, Beis Din has not really ruled on criminal cases. Nevertheless, as we proceed, we will see some poskim actually have commented on the value of tissue testing for criminal justice, although again, that is not the focus of the poskim, so we moved it more to a kind of somewhat less dramatic case of a young person with an older person, which I assume is supposed to represent paternity or family relations. So in the secular legal system, the most common question of identity is probably for criminal justice, while in halacha, the most common and most dramatic question of identity is, of course, in the context of aguna, The halacha is that if a man disappears, his wife normally cannot remarry. Today we use aguna to refer largely to a different situation where a man's husband will not give a get, the recalcitrant husband, but classic aguna, most of the literature refers to the case where the man is not around, he disappears. And we would like to conclude that he's dead. If we haven't heard from him for a long time, we would like to conclude that he's dead. Halacha has elaborate rules for when we're allowed to make that conclusion. We can't just assume it. There are many, many detailed and complicated rules. A large subtopic in aguna is always when you have a cadaver and you would like to determine that this cadaver is indeed the person who's missing. Now, if it's a fresh cadaver and you can recognize it, that's great. But if it's undergone decomposition or it's mutilated, bombings, other things, so drownings, you recover the body later, it can be very difficult or impossible to make a direct recognition. So forensic methods are turned to. We try to use any available method we can. Dental records, fingerprints, tissue testing is one of them. So in halacha, that's probably the primary case where we try to do identification of a person via forensic methodologies, aguna. So in the last 50 years, the tshuvas, as we'll see, the discussions of identifying human remains via forensic methods, including tissue testing, is one of the most important areas of halacha where DNA methodologies and blood typing is discussed. Paternity in halacha is primarily relevant to two main topics. One of them, where halacha shares in common with secular law, is child support. A father, not a mother, but a father has formal halachic obligations to maintain his child, whether born in wedlock or out of wedlock. It is therefore imperative to know if we have a child of uncertain parentage, we need to determine whether a putative individual is his father or not. And so again, this is a question that obviously has concerned people for poskim for thousands of years. Up till pretty recently, we didn't have these kinds of methods, so an elaborate system had developed about circumstantial evidence and various claims by the putative father, the mother, other people. But again, in the last half century or so, we have developed these modern scientific methods, and the poskim began to discuss, particularly in Eretz Yisrael, urgently the question of to what extent can we rely on these methods to determine paternity with regard to child support. The other major question in halacha for which forensic methodology is crucial is mamzeris. To determine paternity is mamzeris. Mamzeris in halacha is defined very differently from the term bastardy in common parlance. In halacha, being born out of wedlock does not in and of itself have major halachic significance. The problem is a child born out of certain forbidden unions is considered a mamzer and has very, very grave halachic restrictions placed on him regarding who he can marry. So there are various kinds of forbidden unions, incest, but by far the most common situation is adultery. If a woman bears a child, a married woman bears a child from a man other than her husband, even if it's not her fault, even in the case of rape, the child is a mamzer and is severely restricted as to who he can marry. So questions began to arise. So again, halacha has treated such questions for thousands of years, questions where we have other kinds of circumstantial evidence that rule out, say, the husband as the father. The most obvious case is where the husband's been away for a year and the woman bears a child a year after the last time her husband was home. So again, there are halachas that the child is presumed to be a mamzer. In general, though, barring those kinds of cases, halacha has a very strong presumption that a child born to a married woman is legitimate and is the child of her husband. Halacha actually parallels secular law in this area too. In America, for sure, there is a very strong presumption that the husband of a married woman is the father of her child. Actually, the secular law presumption is much stronger than halacha. In some states, it was actually considered an irrebuttable presumption. Evidence wasn't even allowed into court to rebut the presumption of paternity. Halacha has always been much more even-handed about this. Halacha has always allowed evidence to refute paternity of the father, but again, until modern science, it was very difficult to do. It was very hard to find conclusive evidence. A husband who was home and together with his wife, it was typically very hard to find real, solid, convincing evidence that he was not the father. The one possible example they had was if the husband could be known sterile, if he had a medical condition, if he had a physiological condition, which halacha recognizes as absolutely sterile, then in those cases we might be able to conclude that he was not the father of the child. But in general, in most cases, it was very difficult until modern science. And again, beginning about half a century ago, questions began to arise about the use of modern forensic methods to determine paternity, to rule out someone as the parent, for example, the husband, to verify someone as the parent. As we discussed, inclusion and exclusion, Poskim began to debate these topics. Now, it's crucial to understand that halacha has very elaborate rules, again, predating modern methods by millennia. Halacha has very elaborate rules for what sort of evidence is accepted and how much significance it carries. And the key thing to understand here is that each of these topics has its own set of rules for what evidence we look at, what evidence, what threshold is required. So for example, in the context of an aguna, a woman who would like to remarry on the presumption that her husband is dead. So on the one hand, we have the problem that a woman remarrying is a very serious issue. We call it davar sheba erva, potential adultery if the husband is still alive. On the other hand, halacha tries really, really hard to find a heter because the poor woman is stuck her whole life this way. So on the one hand, we find major kulas, mishum iguna hikilu, Chazal tried very hard to find bases for leniency for aguna. On the other hand, the subject is very serious. So here you kind of find countervailing pressures, both pressure for kula, pressure for chumra. On the other hand, when it comes to something like mamzerus, when it comes to illegitimacy, here we find unequivocally a very, very strong push toward leniency. There is a strong attitude in halacha, essentially, of sweeping things under the rug. We can't actually dismiss actual evidence, but there very much is an attitude in the poskim of don't ask, don't tell. If we don't have an actual shaila, we don't go digging, we don't look for problems. Based on the Gemara says, ki mach nitma nitma, once a person's lineage is gotten lost or is uncertain, we let sleeping dogs lie. So in general, mamzerus is one issue, and as we'll see, this is reflected in the poskim who discuss forensic methods. Mamzerus is one particular issue that the poskim really don't want to make trouble. If there isn't a smoking gun in front of us, we don't try to dig up problems. Civil cases, for example, child support. So that's treated roughly as a regular civil case. There are the rights of the defendant. If we're suing the father, the putative father, for support, then the burden of proof is on the plaintiff. The plaintiff is the child, or basically will appoint somebody to argue on behalf of the child. But it's like any other civil case where the defendant has a strong presumption of he can't be chayev, we can't find him liable unless we have solid proof in his favor. So it's treated much against him. It's treated much as any other civil case where the burden of proof is on the plaintiff to establish, again, whether it's beyond a reasonable doubt or that's a discussion we'll turn to a little bit later, exactly what the standard of proof is. But roughly speaking, it has the same standards as an ordinary civil case. Anytime somebody wants to be motzi money, somebody wants to get based in to force a defendant to pay, so there are common rules for what standards of proof are required. So now let's discuss some of the actual comments of the poskim. So again, most of the discussion of the poskim exists in the last half century, where these methods were discovered, where they became practical. The truth is, however, the very first source in Jewish literature, not strictly a halachic source, but the very first source goes back about 800 years to the Sefer Hasidim, Rabbi Yehuda Chassid's famous work in medieval Germany. And the truth is, he records a tradition. If the tradition is reliable, then it goes back another several centuries to the Gaonic period, and according to some traditions, even to King Solomon, the wisest of all men. Sefer Hasidim records a dramatic little anecdote. It reads like something right out of the Arabian Nights. There was a man who traveled away from home where he wasn't recognized, a man of property, a man of wealth, and he had a servant, a slave, and he also had a son. The man died far from home, and the slave saw his chance. He decided to usurp his master's position, and he said, I'm the son, and he's the servant. And the son said, no, you're not. I'm the son. You're the servant. Nobody had any proof. They were far from home. Nobody recognized anything. So what to do? So the story goes, as recorded by Rabbi Yehuda Chassid, they went to Rav Sadia Gaon, one of the greatest of all the Gaonim, the leaders in the Babylonian yeshivas before 1,000 years ago. And Rav Sadia referred him to the king, the caliph, whoever it was, and said, go talk to the king. The king saw he was out of his depth. This was above his pay grade. So he referred them to Rav Sadia, who apparently he recognized as a wise man, and said, here, I don't know what to do with this. You solve this case for me. So Rav Sadia ordered the following forensic procedure. He's told each of the two candidates for master to donate some blood separately into two separate bowls. Then they took a bone from the cadaver of the father, They dip the bone sequentially into the two bowls of blood, and as the story is described, the bone that turned out to the blood that turned out to belong to the servant Lo Nivla Hadam was not absorbed in the bone. The other bowl of blood was absorbed. The bone was bloodophilic or bloodophobic, you know, however you say that exactly in modern scientific parlance. So Rav Saadia said, you're the son, you're not the son. He says, etem atamai basar basari. The actual context of this passage in the Sefer Chassidim is quite amusing. The Sefer Chassidim is trying to make the point that it's appropriate for a son to fast on the day of his father's death because they have a very close kinship, because he's bone of his bone, flesh of his flesh, and kind of in support of this, or as a kind of illustration of this, he brings this story. So the halachic context is, or the whatever it is, the practical context is quite far from stating this as a reliable forensic procedure in serious civil and family law cases, but the story itself is recorded, again, about 800 years ago in the Sefer Chassidim, and again, poskim object, they say you can't bring any kind of precedent from this. This is not a halachic work, this is a story of uncertain provenance. As I mentioned, some of the commentators record versions attributing this to Shlomo HaMelech. So anyway, this is basically the very first source widely quoted in Jewish literature of some sort of forensic test. In this case, it was to determine paternity, not identity, but paternity. And the story goes that Rav Saadia Gaon relied on this test to make some kind of determination of paternity. So, as I said, as I keep saying, the actual discussion of this in a serious halachic way begins about 50 years ago. We begin in Eretz Yisrael, primarily, about 50 years ago. This was before DNA was understood well, before practical methods, certainly, for testing and verifying DNA were understood. At that point, the testing, tissue testing, bedikat rikmot, as the literature refers to it, the methods that were understood were blood typing. So we have, on the simplest level, we have what they call ABO testing. People have one of four blood types, A, B, O, variations of those. They have one of several blood types. So obviously, if you have two tissue samples that have the same type, that does not tell you very much. Even the rarest of the types, there are still many people who have them. On the other hand, if the types don't match, then you can pretty much rule out identity. And parentage too, depending on what the son inherits from the father and the mother, you know, if you the genetic rules are well understood, the way these are transmitted. This was always well understood how the types and other factors are transmitted from parent to child. So back then it was much easier to definitively exclude somebody, and including somebody, at least in the early stages, was much more difficult. Later, as the science progressed, there were other ways of testing blood, particularly HLA, human leukocyte antigen testing, which was much more specific. There was a much more variety of types. You can get an identity with a much greater level of confidence. In particular, as will be relevant for some of our discussion, ABO testing was typically done on red blood cells. Human leukocyte antigen testing, leukocyte or white blood cells, were done on white blood cells. Now, while it's not immediately obvious why halacha should particularly care whether something is done on a red blood cell or a white blood cell, this actually makes a significant difference. There's a Gemara in Nida. The Gemara in Nida makes a somewhat difficult to understand, somewhat obscure statement. The Gemara says there are three partners in a person, in the generation of a human being: God, his father, and his mother. The white material of a person comes from the father, that is bones, gidim, sinews, tiparnayim, fingernails, moach, all the barosho, loven shabayin, the white of the eye. All the white stuff comes from the father. Ima mazras odem, the mother contributes the red parts of the body, from whence comes aru basar, flesh and skin, sa'aros, hair, shachar shabayin, and the black of the eye. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives the spirit, the animating part, the intangible parts. Ruach, neshama, klas darpanav, ries ayin, sense perception, form of the face, spirit, soul, shmias ha'ozen, other senses, hearing, dibur peh, hilach reglayim, locomotion, bina v'haskel, intelligence, consciousness. So the Gemara claims that the red part of the body comes from the mother. And rather surprising to our understanding, many poskim, beginning about 50 years ago, summarily rejected ABO blood typing, any blood typing that came from the red blood cells, based on the fact that it was a contradiction to this Gemara. The first one to make this point was Rabban Zion Meir Chayuziel, the great Sephardic chief rabbi of half a century ago. He categorically dismissed the reliability, the halachic acceptability of any testing which, the question was paternity. The question was determining paternity via matching factors in the blood, excluding or including paternity via matching factors in the blood to that of the putative father. And he summarily dismissed the possibility of doing so on the grounds that it flatly contradicts this Gemara. He says, he was talking about mizonos, about child support. We do not rely on scientific inspection of the tissue because Chazal told us that the father does not contribute the blood. And he writes very definitively, kol bedika madait, any scientific test, mitbatelet neged kabbalatam hanemana shel Chazal, is void in the face of the reliable mesorah of Chazal, shekol divrei nemar baruch hakodesh, everything they have said was said baruch hakodesh, baruch shebachar behem of mishnasam, blessed is he, blessed is God who chose them and their teaching. And this is by no means an outlying position. Many gedolei haposkim, particularly in Eretz Yisrael, as a matter of fact, I think it would be safe to say the strong consensus of poskim 50 years ago rejected the reliance on, particularly on ABO blood typing to determine paternity, on the ground that it contradicts the Gemara in Nida. Rav Avadia Yosef, writing somewhat later, summarizes the dispute and says, the Achronim of our generation wrote that we should not rely on Bedikas Hadam to determine paternity. He quotes a bunch of Achronim. He says there was one exception, Rav Herzog. He says who did rely completely on this Bedika. Rav Avadia ruled, Achri Rabim Lahatas. Rav Avadia said, this is already, I think, in the 80s he wrote this, that we follow the consensus view, the majority view. We do not rely on blood typing. Now, those who held this view, as I said, were a large contingent of fairly mainstream, you know, we're not talking about anti-science fanatics, it's Tzitz Eliezer, Rav Waldenberg, Rav Yisrael Veltz, Rav Yeshua Menachem Ehrenberg, the Dvar Yeshua, Rav Yaakov Rosenthal, I believe. Many, many mainstream Gedolei Eretz Yisrael completely rejected the possibility of relying on blood typing to determine paternity, to exclude or include paternity. Tzitz Eliezer says it makes no difference, excluding or including, since the reason is that it contradicts the Gemara, we simply place no reliance on it whatsoever. And as we saw, culminating in Rav Avadia. As Rav Avadia notes, however, there was a dissenting view. It was a minority view in terms of shared numbers. This view was that of Rav Herzog. Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog, the first Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael, formerly of Ireland, one of the greatest Gedolei Torah of the 20th century, probably the only one of that level with a PhD, University of London, other European schools, well-versed in chemistry. He was vehemently opposed to this view. He was just beside himself. He could not understand how anyone could take such a position. He has a remarkable letter published initially, I believe, by Professor Dov Frymer, who has probably the definitive article on tissue typing, published in Asia, Shnasana Mishpat Ivri. Rav Herzog was just beside himself that anyone would take a view that he considered so benighted and so completely out of touch with reality. He says, Lo achached, I says, I can't deny, kimad boshti v'nechlamti. I'm just embarrassed for what you've written, he said. He doesn't say who he was writing to. It might have been Rabbi Zeal. It might have been one of the other proponents of this view. He says, this dismissive attitude toward exclusionary testing, which again, exclusionary testing was much more reliable than inclusionary testing. He says, I don't understand. Hackett says, what do you tell me? He says, are the doctors believe, they not believe? He says, it's a fact. Go do it in the library. It works, he says. It's not open for debate, he says. It just works. He says, we're not discussing some theoretical question of who's right and who's wrong, he says. It's reproducible. It's demonstrable. It just works, he says. How can you deny such a thing? And he closes with an incredibly sharp criticism of his opponents. He writes, what a pity, he says. Science is advancing and conquering worlds, Megala Sode Sodos, revealing the most deepest secrets of creation. Im Gam Ki Yuto Leprakim, it makes errors. Your science is not a completely monotonic progression forward. Sometimes the mistakes are made, we have to backtrack. But on the whole, science is doing incredible things, he says. And Anu, he says, we, the Jewish community, Bekesher L'nyanei Mada Hanogim L'Torah Kedosha, he says, regarding the intersection of science and Torah, Mishakim Roshenu Bechol Ka'of Hayadua. We stick our heads in the sands like that well-known bird, the ostrich, basically, and we say we don't see. We say, the Gemara says so. Rav Herzog basically was just, as I said, beside himself, could not understand how serious Talmid HaChamim could possibly disagree. And he wasn't the only dissenter. Rav Adi Hadaya has a tshuva, psak on the Beis Din, where he ruled that we do rely on testing. Rav Chaim David Regensburg, one of the Rosh Yeshiva of Skokie, HDC in Chicago, one of the heads of the CRC, also has a tshuva where he wholeheartedly endorses blood testing. He says it's reliable, it works. And the basic point is, just intuitively, it's certain. If done properly, it can yield. When it yields results that are unimpeachable, he says, what's not to like? How can you not rely on such a thing, he says. It's a factual, demonstrable thing, he says. So how can you not rely on it? But anyway, this was the first round of the discussion back, again, about half a century ago, where, if anything, there was a fairly strong consensus against relying on this testing, and a minority view, albeit a sometimes vociferously expressed one, that we should rely, that we absolutely do rely on such testing. Now, in addition to the objection from the Gemara in Nida, the theological objection that our tradition denies this, there were a number of other objections raised. Some of them, clearly would fall by the wayside today. Some of them just express that they don't feel the science is conclusive. They think it's too new, it's too speculative. And again, you'd have to be a historian of science to compare each tshuva, how well the science was understood, how reliable the techniques were back then. But again, most of those arguments, I think, can be the ones that were based on an actual assessment, a serious assessment of the newness and unreliability of the science. Obviously, as science develops, we have to reevaluate the halacha. And those posting themselves would have been the first to admit that. But that's not an argument, I think, that need concern us overly. One particularly interesting argument, and in this is raised by Rav Waldenberg, the Tzitz Eliezer, who was a man who knew a great deal of science. He corresponded with many of the leading doctors, religious doctors of the age, and he was well-versed in science. He actually takes the Rav Uziel's view, the very dismissive view of blood typing based on the Gemara. But one of his ancillary arguments, one of his supplementary arguments, it turns out to be quite prescient, not necessarily dispositive, but raises a fascinating point. That is the question of the chimerism. You learn in high school biology that a child gets his DNA from his parents, that each person has two copies of all his DNA, two copies of all his chromosomes and genes, one from the father, one from the mother, and that when a child is born, he gets some from the father, some from the mother, double X, XY, blue eyes, black eyes, brown eyes, etc., so on and so forth. Turns out, as is usually the case, reality is considerably more messy. And while you learn in high school biology that all a person's cells contain the identical genes, identical DNA, this is actually not the case. There is something called chimerism. Not exactly clear how to pronounce this, but the chimera or the chimera was an old beast of Greek mythology. It was a horrific monster comprising several different monsters somehow stuck together. In modern biology, the chimera is a person who has cells that have completely distinct genetic material. Completely, if you would do a test on one cell and do a test on a different cell, you would see that there is completely different genetic material in the cells. How does this happen? So there are three or four basic ways this can occur, and some of them are rather more common than others. The most common case, where some have argued that most people actually have some degree of this, is what they call microchimerism, where a person is mostly one genetic line, but has a few cells scattered throughout his body that may have a different genetic makeup. This is caused typically by cells crossing the placenta from mother to fetus, from fetus to mother, from one twin to another in utero. And basically, the way we understand things today, most of a person's cells come in the orderly, neat manner of high school biology from his parents, but there is this messiness that sometimes some of the mother's cells float off and enter the baby. Baby cells go back up to the mother. So a person will occasionally have a few cells that are not the same as the rest of his genetic makeup. This can basically be disregarded in a forensic context because they're just so tiny, the number is so small. All the methods we use for tissue typing involve multiple cells, many cells, and halacha we would say buckled the miuto, and forensically we would say they don't create any real problem in the profiling of the DNA, that these few cells don't contribute meaningfully to any typical statistical analysis of what a person's DNA is. There are, however, some cases of chimerism which are much rarer, but also much more dramatic and much more significant. One example can occur, kind of a trivial example, but after a blood transfusion. A person who has blood transfused from somebody else, so the blood running in his veins and arteries is now a mixture of his native blood plus the blood that he received from somebody else. And that would normally be fairly temporary until that blood, you know, dies and is replaced by his own blood. But at least if a test were done right then, if a test were done in his blood, not other tissue, but the blood, so the profile of DNA that would be generated from that blood would have a mixture of, it would be the same thing pretty much as a crime scene. If you took blood and you saw, and you had, let's say, the victim's blood and the aggressor's blood were mixed together, in the lab you would see pretty much two different bloods were there. Same thing would happen if you took blood from one person and he had a blood transfusion, you would get similar results. So again, this would typically show up in the laboratory. People who are trained at performing these tests know how to recognize this. And again, they would see that you have blood from two different people. They would either conclude that the sample has been contaminated or is a mixture, or if not, then they would realize that there was this issue of, you know, fairly trivial chimerism. A more problematic and rarer but more interesting case can come about through, say, organ transplantation or bone marrow transplantation. In this case, A, it's permanent. For the rest of the person's life, all the cells of his body will have one genetic makeup, except for the cells of the donated organs, which will have a different makeup. In the case of the bone marrow transplant, where the cells are generated from the marrow, the blood will have one type of genetic makeup. Other tissue would have a different type of genetic makeup. There was actually a case about 10 years ago where they had, there was a criminal case. They had, I think in Alaska, they had a case where they had a rapist. The semen didn't match the saliva. The same guy, the genetic material came out. Originally they had excluded him on the basis of a saliva test, and it turned out that the cells in his reproductive organs were from a different line than the cells in his, I don't remember how that came about, but that stuff can really throw off forensic testing. There was another case where they matched with, there was a crime committed, they matched the DNA against the databases, they matched it with a guy who turned out to have been in jail when the crime was committed. Turned out he was the brother of the accused, and he had given a bone marrow transplant, and the cells in his blood were actually matched his brother. So the brother who had committed the crime left DNA which matched this guy who they had tested his blood in jail. These cases can really throw off, obviously, forensic testing, because you're not going to get a mixture. If you test one part of the body, you're going to get totally one genetic profile. You test another part of the body, you'll get a completely consistent but completely different genetic profile. So these are rare. Most of these are fairly rare, but these potentially are something that you have to take into account if you're doing forensic testing. You have to be aware of the guy's medical history, and apparently not very clear, you know, what the standards are. At least, you know, to a layman, it's not very clear how they make sure to eliminate these possibilities. This whole idea of chimerism was first brought to my attention by a friend of mine, Dr. Harvey Babich, the chair of the bio department at Stern College. He likes these genetic kind of, you know, the non-high school biology textbook genetics. He gave me a couple of articles on this, and, you know, this has made it to law journals. The law journals already discuss how forensic testing in a legal context can avoid these problems. Anyway, returning to Tzitzil Eliezer, he doesn't articulate all this, but he basically alludes to he discusses the possibility of a chimera. He says a person might have a different sort of blood than his normal blood. For example, he says transfusion, he says, when maybe dialysis or something, different things that to take a person's blood out and put other blood in. He says that's another reason why you can't be so quick to rely on blood typing. So again, as we've said, a normal transfusion would yield a unique profile of mixed blood, and we'd be able to separate out both profiles, but there are going to be cases, and marrow transplants or others, where the blood typing might not be as reliable as we would like. Another objection raised by Rav Waldenberg is that, at the end of the day, he says, science, you know, the exact opposite of referred to, he says, science is not so reliable. Science changes its mind. Science backtracks, he says. Anything science says has to be taken with a grain of salt. Rav Waldenberg, again, for all his comfortableness and familiarity with the medical science of his day, occasionally exhibits this very skeptical attitude toward science. And again, it's really hard to understand how he could have taken this position. Some have suggested he only said this back then when the science was newer, more speculative. I mean, every time I go on an airplane, I'm relying on the engineering. I'm relying on two things. I'm relying on the theory behind it, and I'm relying on the fact that the last 10,000 airplanes have flown successfully, and it seems to work. So the same thing, we find many posts can make the same point discussing these forensic methods. A, the science is sound, and B, it works. We've done this thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of times. The results are consistent, reproducible, reliable, and therefore to argue that the science is dubious is a difficult position to swallow. The truth is, though, we do have to concede, even putting aside the sensational stuff of the chimeras, we do have to, the science must be understood. The science does yield conclusions of differing degrees of reliability. So for example, back in the exclusionary days and inclusionary days, we were using blood typing, so exclusion was very solid. If you found blood that didn't match the blood he could have had from his parents, he clearly wasn't the parent. There's no way he could have had, again, barring the contamination or lab incompetence or chimeras, it was pretty solid. Inclusion was always much more guesswork. You had to rely on statistics and guessing, because any given factor, as we said, with ABO typing and individual antigens, any given factor could be fairly common. Typically, the way things are done, we compare multiple markers, and each one raises the probability until we compare enough that using statistical methods, we can determine that the odds of matching so many factors gets vanishingly small. So ultimately, you are dealing with probabilities, and that's where a lot of the literature is. In halacha, how does halacha deal with methods which are combinations of smaller matches, none of which are dispositive? When you have enough of them and you make sure you do the math right and the science right, when you have enough of them, it yields a conclusion any of us would rely on to risk our life on, 1 in 100 billion, 1 in 100 trillion, you can get the numbers arbitrarily high. So at what point does halacha say this is certainty, not just a guess, not just probably? At what point does probably translate into certainly and definitely? That's where a lot of the halacha, a lot of the debates occur. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, we don't really have a formal discussion from him. We have various quotes from him on the topic. And he kind of vacillated, may have moved as time went on. We have a few conflicting statements from him, quoted by Rabbi Avraham Sofer Abraham, one of the great writers of halacha and medicine in our day, a doctor, a Rav. So he says, first he quotes Rav Shlomo Zalman as saying, not to get too carried away with Chazal, he says, the Chazal, you can't always take what they say at face value. He wasn't belittling Chazal, he was just saying that they might have meant it in a deeper or metaphysical sense. The Chazal may not have meant literally that the blood of a person comes from his mother. So the Gemara is not conclusive, he says. Then he says that we shouldn't rely on the Bedikah so much. You know, he didn't really want to rely on such forensics, only maybe in combination with other arguments. Then he goes on, he discusses a case later in life. He discussed a case in a hospital where one of these nightmare stories where two kids got mixed up and they weren't sure which one belonged to which parent. The question is, can we use forensic testing to determine whose baby was whose? Like in the Shlomo HaMelech story, here they were both alive. I think they just wanted to figure out whose was whose. Rav Shlomo Zalman did concede that we can. He says, if this particular test is accepted, reliable, it's repeated testing, it's accurate, he says, then you could, halacha can rely on this, he says, and similarly for paternity, for child support, he says, if the testing proves reliable, then we can, halacha will rely on such testing. Rav Eliashiv also is someone who seems to have accepted the validity of genetic testing. Rav Eliashiv has one printed tshuva in his Kovetz tshuvas. He was asked about mamzerus. He was asked about a case, there was an allegation by a mother that the child was born out of wedlock, a married woman who said she had committed adultery and the child was therefore a mamzer. Now, the halacha is a mother's claim is actually not taken seriously. We simply disregard it. It has no credibility in halacha. The child is perfectly kosher. The question was, that was true for thousands of years when we couldn't do anything more. All we had was her word, and we simply disregard her word. Not because she's a woman. We disregard anybody's word. Except the father, who has a special status, we generally disregard any single person who makes an unsubstantiated allegation of mamzerus. So the question is, what about today? Today we have forensic testing. Should the mother's allegation at least trigger the need to do a test and see? Maybe she's right. Maybe she's telling the truth. Rav Eliashiv ruled, no, we do not perform such a test. And he brings the story of Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid. And he says that the test might be reliable, but nevertheless, he concludes that we don't do the test. And basically, the position I mentioned earlier, that when it comes to mamzerus in particular, the attitude is let sleeping dogs lie. If the woman's allegation doesn't yield a suffix, it has zero credibility, and therefore, al pi halacha, we are not concerned. We don't open the Pandora's box by testing the child. Now, Rabbi Yashiv doesn't say this explicitly, but the tshuva strongly indicates, as I said before, that if we would do the test, if someone went ahead and did it against rabbinic advice and it yielded a bad result, it would be credible. His whole argument is we don't want to know, so we don't do the test. But he strongly implies that the test itself would be dispositive, and therefore, if we had reason to do it for other purposes, and not a question of Amzeris, for example, Aguna or something, he strongly suggests that the test would have halachic weight, and that seems to be his position. And indeed, he's also quoted directly, this is not published, but he's also quoted directly by Rabbi Abraham again, as having said, black and white, that yes, we would rely on genetic testing for Aguna. He says, Rabbi Yashiv said, that Rabbi Abraham says in the year Tufshin Samachay, 2005, I asked Rabbi Yashiv directly, he says, what's the deal with DNA? Can we rely on it for Aguna? He said, why not? We rely on fingerprints, he said. We rely on dental records, Tzilumei Shinayim, x-rays, or however they get pictures of the teeth, he said. I asked him, does that mean the Bedikah is like a Siman Mufak, which is the standard for Aguna? The answer was yes. So according to Rabbi Abraham, in a verbal conversation, Rabbi Yashiv said, no problem, we rely on forensic methods of DNA testing to permit an aguna. In general, the most important literature on this question of aguna, on permitting aguna based on DNA testing, this arose out of the tragedy of the terrorist attack on the Twin Towers on September 11th. There were a number of Jews who lost their lives or disappeared in that attack, and there were major halakhic discussions post-Kim in the United States, post-Kim in Eretz Yisrael, debating, discussing, finding heterim for several women whose husbands were presumed dead in that attack. One of the problems was we didn't really have cadavers. They had some tissue, but they were typically fragments, and they certainly couldn't be identified using normal visual methods. One of the questions was, there were many other questions involving other shalas and aguna, but one of the questions, the one pertinent to us, is do we rely on forensic testing to establish that the tissue we have is indeed from the person who's missing and presumed dead. So here there was some dispute. The most important tshuva on this topic was written by Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, one of the leading authorities on Chasam Mishpat and Aben Ezer. I guess full disclosure, I hold ordination from him, but he is widely regarded as one of the leading experts in our generation on Chasam Mishpat and Aben Ezer. He ruled emphatically, on the last page, he ruled emphatically that DNA testing is reliable. I have a brief excerpt here. He says, the Misrad HaRafui HaRashi Shal Medinat New York, the chief health ministry of the state of New York, identified in Chodesh Tammuz via Bedikas DNA. DNA is spelled lots of different ways in the halachic literature, sometimes Dalad Nun Aleph, sometimes DNA, sometimes Dalad Yud space Ayin Nun space Aleph Yud, but you figure it out from context. So they recognized some of the bones from the ribcage of Mr. A. They don't give the names there. Now, I left out the part where he describes the gory details of exactly how much material was found. Obviously, if you find a couple of cells, that's nothing. Maybe he scratched his finger on the way out of the building. So the first thing you have to establish is, was the tissue sample large enough that a person couldn't survive missing that part of the body? Anyway, it was large enough that we conclude that if that's him, he's dead. So Rav Goldberg says, they compared the DNA in this case. For some reason, they didn't have a sample of his own DNA. Typically, this is done via things like toothbrushes, bits of saliva or hair on a brush or a comb, fibers on garments. But for whatever reason, it seems in this case, they didn't use tissue from the missing person's own body. Instead, they were comparing DNA found at the attack site with parental DNA. So he says they ran these comparisons, ulefi ha-statistika, ha-sikui she-yesh acharam DNA, zehu pachus me-echad v'meya v'shivim v'arba million. The odds of this being a false positive, a match by someone else, would be less than 1 in 174 million. The number is actually erroneous. This was a significant misprint. They were off by a factor of 1,000. The number in question should have been something more like 174 billion. I know this, A, because in another text of the tshuva, that's the number printed, and B, because in another part of this tshuva, which I omitted, Rav Goldberg makes the claim that this number is more than all the people who lived from the time of creation until today. There are more than 174 million people alive in the United States today. Therefore, it's clear that the number he meant was actually off by a factor of 1,000. And the other text is correct. But anyway, it was an astronomically small probability of this occurring by chance, something all of us would take as a certainty. So Rav Goldberg says, absolutely, yesh lismocha lahatir aguna al pi bedikas DNA, black and white, we're allowed to rely on DNA testing to permit an aguna. It's pashut, he says, same as Rav Yashiv, it's a siman mufak. And then he brings a famous chazal. Chazal say that God is a master artist, a human being, if he has one mold from which he stamps coins, print something out, each copy will be identical to every other copy. God created all of humanity through one model, Adam Arishon, the first man, and every person is different. The Gemara is not talking about DNA. The Gemara is talking about facial structure. Every person looks different. Rav Goldberg says that's also the godless of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that every person, even though we all genetically descend from Adam, every person has unique DNA, and the DNA is perfectly reliable. That's also the gedulah of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that every person has unique DNA. DNA, he says again, is exactly like the form of a person's face, and just like his fingerprints, he says, and again, dental records, tzilum shinov, picture of a person, he says, post can rely on photographic evidence, he says. The halacha in general is that anything which has been proved, been reproducibly proved to be reliable, we absolutely rely on. Again, and it's preposterous to argue, he basically says, preposterous to argue that we shouldn't rely on it based on some kind of technical or formal objection. He says it's absolutely conclusive, convincing evidence, and there's nothing to talk about. Says, why not rely on this? And even though in his case there were other tzirufim, there were other reasons to be matir, it's fairly clear that he considered this a or the primary reason to be lenient. There's a widely quoted article originally published in Truman, reproduced in various other sources, of rulings by the Beis Din of Rav Shmuel Vosner in Bnei Brak, one of the leading Batei Din in Eretz Yisrael. Their ruling is actually two or three pages worth. They were asked a number of questions by the police rabbinate in Israel. I'm not sure exactly what that is, but apparently there's a division of the rabbinate associated with the police force about they were dealing with missing persons or other questions. He says, so they consulted with Rav Osner's Beis Din about what is halakha's stance on the reliability of identifying tissue or paternity via forensic methods. And they gave a list of rulings. Their rulings are without reasoning and frustratingly brief. But nevertheless, it is, you know, this is a very widely quoted discussion. It's worth summarizing some of their conclusions. They discussed about five different questions. Burial. Can we bury different tissue of uncertain provenance in the same grave? Do we do avelus based on DNA? If the guy's missing and you find the cadaver you identified by DNA, do we mourn for him? The formal rules of avelus. Mamzerus, can we determine somebody to be a mamzer based on this? Yerusha, inheritance, if we're not sure somebody's a Yarish, certain relatives are Yarish, can we determine this or rule somebody out via DNA? And aguna, can we matter an aguna based on DNA? So they had a kind of mixed set of rulings. Their rulings are burial, okay, they said. Avelus, they said yes, although only for a single person, not for a married person. That is a seemingly inexplicable distinction until one remembers the halacha in Hilchos Aguna, that we are much more strict about allowing a married woman to mourn for a presumed dead husband, because if you haven't met the standard of heter aguna, mourning may allow people to conclude that he's dead, and you might come to matir an aguna. So anytime there's an aguna issue, we're much more strict about blocking mourning until we're absolutely sure the guy's dead. Yerusha, it depends. Whether there are other Yarshim who are Vadai and you're trying to compete with them, then DNA is not acceptable. If there are no other Yarshim, we don't know what to do with the money, then the standard is lower. We allow determining a Yarish based on DNA. Criminal justice, they say absolutely not. Criminal justice, again, this is not halacha l'maisa really, but they say criminal justice, absolutely not. We require two edim, and all these circumstantial evidence types of arguments are not enough to convict. This is not universally accepted. Rav Chaim David Regensburg of Chicago, again, he wasn't writing l'maisa, we weren't doing criminal justice, but he strongly argues that yes, criminal justice can be done based on ironclad, airtight, evidence. The standard might be higher than the American standard of beyond a reasonable doubt, but halacha does allow, even without edim, he argues, you know, bringing numerous sources, halacha does allow, he argues, the conviction of somebody based on 100% certain circumstantial evidence. The kind of evidence being discussed by the early poskim is what we talk about as locked room situations, where two people are in a room, one of them comes with a, one of them is found with a wound on his head, a fatal or a wound that causes injury, that it's a bite mark, couldn't have been done by anybody but somebody with a set of teeth, only one person was in the room. So again, you know, in the mystery novels, there always is some solution how it was actually somebody else or how it happened, but in general, halacha recognizes these type of locked room situations as dispositive, and Rabbi Regensburg argues that DNA is so, like Rav Goldberg, so absolutely 100% compelling, again, that you can yield, depending on the quality of your sample and other factors, you can get results of varying reliability, but in general, he says, in principle, if you have a result that is conclusive enough, you could even convict somebody criminally. Yes.
Yeah, I just wondered why DNA was considered circumstantial evidence rather than direct evidence.
So, it's hard to know because halacha historically didn't have these methods, so the gold standard of evidence in halacha was always eyewitness testimony. Now, as people point out, as the legal profession today says, today we don't recognize eyewitness testimony as being all that reliable. There are all kinds of questions of mistaken identity, but traditionally halacha basically establishes eyewitness testimony as the gold standard, two valid witnesses as the gold standard, one witness as a secondary level for certain purposes. Anything short of that is considered circumstantial. Now obviously I understand the problem, which is that the persuasive power of certain kinds of scientific evidence is practically speaking a whole lot stronger. I would stake my life much easier on the airplane's going to fly and on other scientific things than I would on two people I've never met before making a claim about something. The Gemara itself has cases where witnesses were paid to lie, where witnesses were corrupt or mistaken. So that is a problem, but you know that's difficult. It's a difficult topic. But in general, all I can say, just briefly, in the time we have left, is that halacha has a long-standing tradition of formal rules for how much evidence, how much weight we place in various forms of evidence, and traditionally the gold standard has always been, for whatever the reason is, Xeris Akasuv, or that was all they had, eyewitnesses, and anything short of actual sight was considered circumstantial. There are those who argue that, for example, poskim debate hearing. If you hear something but you don't see something, is that considered actual eidus or not? Some say no, some say yes, and some of the ones who defend DNA argue that it's just as solid and reliable as Rav Goldberg himself brings arguments like this. It's just as solid and reliable evidence as hearing somebody or even seeing something. Now, Rav Goldberg did face some opposition. Some of my erstwhile colleagues in, not people I knew personally, but some of my colleagues in Lakewood did object to his arguments that DNA is absolutely reliable. They didn't challenge the math, they didn't challenge the science. Actually, over Shabbos, I learned some of their paper with my wife. I recognize these words, electrophoresis, statistics, nucleotides, they had a good wrap of the science, they had a good understanding of the statistics. They made a number of formal halakhic arguments that even insofar as we accept the math, we accept the science, basically, the technical arguments are well beyond the scope of our talk, but basically they argued that who says halacha relies on these things? And they went several rounds where Goldberg kept saying, like he kept kind of sidestepping most of their arguments and saying, how can you not rely on this, he says. It's absolutely reliable, it's compelling, it's convincing, he says, just intuitively. He did counter all their technical arguments too, but his basic point was, what sense is there, just a judgment call, what sense is there in rejecting evidence which is absolutely 100% conclusive, he says, How can you possibly not rely on such a thing? Just close with one last source. Rav Shlomo Aviner, one of the leading Dati Lumi Poskim in Eretz Yisrael, he had a case, an actual case of Mamzerus. It was a case where they did the test, unlike Rabbi Yashu's recommendation, and the test apparently demonstrated that the husband was not the father of the child, and therefore he should be a Mamzer. The question Rav Aviner deals with is, do we rely on this test to conclude the child is a mamzer? Rav Aviner rules emphatically that we do not. So he has several arguments. One of them is that even if a child is born out of wedlock to a married woman, there are certain cases where he won't be a mamzer. If the father is a non-Jew, for example, that's actually a fairly problematic answer because that's true, but in general, as I mentioned before, if the husband's away for 12 months, we do usually conclude he's a Suffolk mamzer or a Vade mamzer. We don't necessarily assume the father was a non-Jew. certain cases we do, but in general we don't. One of Rav Aviner's arguments, his main one apparently, which is a truly, truly remarkable argument, is he says, there's a well-established halachic rule. Halacha looks at what's visible to the naked eye. Halacha doesn't concern itself with microscopic things. For example, bugs. Bugs that are invisible except under a microscope, they're not bugs. We have bacteria, we have all kinds of microbes and things. Other examples he brings, things that are only visible via magnifying glasses. A letter in a Sefer Torah, he says, if it has a microscopic crack, only visible under a microscope, that's nothing, he says. So, says Rav Aviner, if you do a test that verifies that this person is not the child of that person, if that test relies on factors which are not visible to the naked eye, which require machinery, lab equipment, and scientific methodology, the Torah doesn't care about that. Since that's not visible to the naked eye, we do not care. This is a bizarre argument, because wherever we apply this rule, we don't care, that means if the actual phenomenon in question is not visible to the naked eye, then it doesn't matter. But here, the question of whether he's the child of him or not is a macroscopic, well-defined phenomenon. The methodology we use is microscopic, but the fact we're trying to determine is a macroscopic fact. We never find such a thing. He has no precedent for such a thing that we ignore macroscopic facts if the methods for determining them are microscopic. There is sort of one precedent, also remarkable tshuva. There's a case of Rav Aaron Levin, writing about 100 years ago in the Sefer Avnei Chefetz. He talked about a case, there was a kashrus question, and there was a lot of things, there were many points that were in doubt, and there was basis to be lenient based on sfeikas, suffix, svek, sveka. We didn't know, so we can be lenient. The question was, he says, wait a second, this might have been true a generation ago, he says, but today we can resolve our doubts. Today they have something called a telephone, he says, where you go to the post office and you pay them money and they can talk to people in other towns. So we can make a phone call and find out what was going on. You don't have to do that, he says. First of all, halacha doesn't require you to investigate further if that investigation is expensive and inconvenient. And going to the post office and paying the money to talk to people in other towns is expensive and inconvenient, he says. Obviously, today it's neither expensive nor inconvenient, but back then that was true. The other argument he makes, a truly remarkable argument, is similar to Rav Aviner. He says the Torah doesn't require you to do things which are kunsin, which are newfangled ideas, all these remarkable new scientific techniques. Halacha establishes rules based on the way human society lived in most of its history. If you have new ways to do things, halacha doesn't particularly care. Now, even he, though, seems to concede at the end, if you did make the phone call and you found out that it was treif, it would be aser. He just says you don't have to make the phone call because halacha doesn't require you to do things which are considered newfangled and unnatural somehow. Even that position is very hard to understand, and even according to him, I doubt he would say that today, where a telephone is, like putting on your socks in the morning, but carrying a cell phone. But 100 years ago, he wrote this in Europe, but even he doesn't say that you disregard an investigation that's based on tachbulos and newfangled science. Rav Aviner has this incredible position that you can actually disregard a test that would determine a macroscopic fact based on the fact that the test itself involves things that are too small to see. That is also some of the, sort of like the position raised by Rav Goldberg's objections, but he takes it much further. Again, Mamzeris is something the poskim were traditionally very makel. They look for kulos, but even in Mamzeris, this is really a remarkable heter.